Wait, wait, don't tell me. The news quiz from NPR.
Saturday at 10 a.m. and Sunday at noon on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We're starting the program today with a Faith Matters conversation. That's where we talk about matters of faith, religion, and spirituality. And today we're about to speak with a woman who is in a very public struggle with her church. Her name is Kathleen Kelly. She's known as Kate, and she is or was a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church. She is also the founder of Ordain Women. That's a group that promotes the ordination of women into the priesthood of the Mormon Church. But on Monday, Kate Kelly was formally excommunicated. A letter to Kelly signed by the bishop of her local church, or stake, said this was due to, quote, conduct contrary to the laws and order of the church, unquote. This means that Kelly, a former missionary, may no longer take the sacrament, contribute tithes and offerings, wear temple garments, offer public prayer, or vote for church officers. Kate Kelly is with us now from member station KUER in Salt Lake City, Utah, to tell us more about her story. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
It sounds like such a lame question, but I wanted to ask, how are you? Is there some analogy you can draw upon that other people might recognize who haven't gone through something like this?
It feels to me like I have been evicted from my spiritual home. I have been stripped of my citizenship, which I have had since birth. And I have been forcibly drawn out of a circle and community that I love.
Very painful, in other words.
Excruciatingly so.
Did you expect this?
I didn't expect this. I think I'm ever the optimist. I had hoped that they would do the right thing. I had hoped that there would be a place for dialogue about gender equality in our church. And I still have that hope in the future, but this has been a major setback for me and my family.
For those who are not familiar with the church law regarding women in the priesthood, could you just describe exactly what it is that women are allowed to do and not allowed to do within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints? I mean, I understand that women can serve as missionaries and they do have leadership positions, but what is it that they can do? What can't they do?
In the Mormon Church, women are given a lot of delegated duties, but they are not allowed to oversee any of those roles. So, for example, when I was a missionary, I was allowed to do the teaching and reaching out to people and contacting them and giving them, a Book of Mormon, but I wasn't allowed to baptize them and I wasn't allowed to be a leader in any sort of capacity. Those roles were all filled by my male counterparts. And in the Mormon Church, all leadership is governed by the priesthood, and all Mormon men have the priesthood. And we have a lay rotating clergy. So the bishop who serves in my ward is a lawyer for Exxon, and you could have a plumber and a teacher and anyone who has any sort of other, profession serves in that capacity on a rotating basis, and it's a voluntary position. And so if women were to be ordained, this would affect not just a small handful of women, but over 7 million women and girls worldwide.
Hmm. Why do you think this happened? Why do you think this got to this point? I mean, you are not the only person who has expressed the view that women should have the opportunity to serve in similar roles. Why do you?
The question of female ordination in the Mormon Church is in some ways very new and in some ways has been going on for decades. There have been a very small handful of women who have been courageously speaking out and agitating on the question of female ordination. That group, since we founded Ordain Women and launched the website ordainwomen.org, has grown exponentially. Now there are hundreds of Mormons publicly stating that they want women to be ordained, and that's never, ever been the case before. So we're at the very tip of the iceberg as far as this conversation goes within Mormonism. We've had purges before. So in the early 90s, there was a purge of 6 prominent Mormon intellectuals and several of them because they spoke out on gender equality issues.
The letter from the bishop, from your bishop, the bishop of your stake, says that The problem is that you have persisted in an aggressive effort to persuade other church members to your point of view and that your course of action has threatened to erode the faith of others. You are entitled to your views, but you are not entitled to promote them and proselyte others to them while remaining in full fellowship in the church. And I think he's referring to demonstrations, for example, right? That there were demonstrations outside of church meetings. And I don't know what else he's referring to, but what about his point? I mean, his point is you have your right to free speech, but we have a right to say that you cannot be considered one of us if you express those views publicly. What about that?
I think the logic of the decision is extremely problematic, because what essentially it threatens is not just one woman who started a group called Ordained Women. It threatens any Mormon person who has a question and wants to ask that question out loud. It's any Mormon person who wants to write a blog post about a concern that they have with doctrine or a sincere desire they have. It's extremely problematic for a person to be punished for having a viewpoint.
Is it that you had a viewpoint, though? Is that you expressed your concerns outside of closed communication channels within the church? I mean, in part what they're saying is that this is a family matter and should have been handled within the family, and you took this outside mm-hmm. of the family.
That's a disingenuous question, because there is no way to handle it within the family. We've sent letters to the leaders of the church, and they just get returned to our local leaders, who have no control. Our local leaders can't ordain us or let us perform ordinances. It's very centrally controlled in Salt Lake City, Utah. And so it's very disingenuous for them to say, well, you should just continue this conversation in your own local congregation, because that's not where the solution lies.
There is an appeals process. Is that something you're looking into?
I intend to appeal. I have 30 days in which I can appeal. But even the disciplinary process in the Mormon Church is very heavily weighted against women. For example, in my case, I was excommunicated by a bishop in my ward, which is my local congregation. But if I were a man, that would have to take place with a stake president who is over the regional area. And it would have to be done by a council of 15 people, whereas in my case, it was handled by 3 people and is much, much less formal. Mm. So because I'm a woman, they were able to essentially summarily dismiss me with very little fanfare.
Well, there is fanfare. There is fanfare now. I mean, and I wanted to ask you about that. What is this like for you? And interesting, I also want to note that in the letter, the bishop says that he's urging you to repent. It says that these penalties are generally imposed for the period of a year, but that if you repent and do not continue your actions, I assume he means your public advocacy, then you can be considered for readmission. What about that? How do you respond to that?
I have nothing to repent of. The only things I've done is live with integrity, tell the truth, and ask sincere questions regarding gender equality with the church. I haven't preached any false doctrine. I just made what's a factual assertion, which is men and women are not equal in our church.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Kate Kelly. She's founder of the group Ordained Women, which seeks the ordination of women within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. She was excommunicated this week for her public advocacy around this issue. Forgive me, I don't know you, but I can hear the emotion in your voice. I can tell that this is a very difficult experience for you. What is keeping you going?
They have taken away my membership, but they can't take away my faith in God. They can't take away my testimony, and they can't take away the feelings that I have and the tradition that I learned, that I am a child of God just as any of my brothers are.
And about, what about your family? May I ask it? How are they responding to this?
My parents are also being targeted for discipline because they will not relinquish their support for me. They both have profiles on the ordainedwomen.org site, and they refuse to take them down. So it's a very, very difficult time for everyone in my family. It's almost as though we were being put through a community shunning on the neighborhood level and on the worldwide scale.
What's it like, though, for you day to day? I understand that you recently moved back to Utah. So if you go to the store, are people mean to you? I mean, if you go to the grocery store, are people mean to you? Do they not speak to you? What's it like?
I am not used to being recognized on the street quite like I am now in Utah. But for the most part, the people that approach me are very kind, very open. Yesterday, a woman who was about 70 years old stopped me on the street and grabbed my shoulders and said, "Are you Kate? You are my hero. And I have been hoping for this my entire life. And that's what keeps me going."
In his letter, your bishop, the letter that he sent informing you of your excommunication, he wrote, "I urge you to continue to attend church, read the scriptures, and pray daily." Is that something you think you can do?
That's something that he has no control over, and something that I'll continue to do on my own accord, because Mormonism doesn't wash off, and it's not something they can take away from me.
I do have to ask you, and I apologize because I do understand that this question could give offense, but there are those who would hear your story and say, go somewhere else. I mean, why not join a denomination that would recognize women as priests and would offer them the opportunity for equal, you know, status in the clergy? Or just, you know, some people might say, why not go and join one of those?
I am very invested in the Mormon community. And this isn't just about me. If it was just about me, I'm an adult, I'm an attorney, I could go on and live a very happy life. But this is bigger than me. This is bigger than the women who are engaged in this cause with me. I have a 3-year-old niece who is growing up in the church, and I think about her. And I think about the ways that she'll be affected by patriarchy and how it will change the way she sees herself. And so I'm doing this for her.
That was Kate Kelly, founder of the group Ordained Women. And we reached her at member station KUER, which is in Salt Lake City, Utah. Kate Kelly, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And I do want to mention that we reached out to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They said their response to the situation was explained in the letter that was sent to Kelly that we talked about on the program, and they have no further comment. Coming up, sports fans are buzzing over this year's sky-high World Cup ratings. We'll ask veteran New York Times sports columnist George Vesey whether America is finally catching on to the beautiful game.
The younger generation, they're familiar with the sport, they like the spectacle, but there's also the broader sense that as younger people are more comfortable with people who are a little bit different.
That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support comes from Bodywork Associates, offering professional, licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Two locations, including inside the Activities and Recreation Center, north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus, and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com.
Are burnt burgers and rubbery ribs ruining your summer cookout? I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday for a look at marinade myths, charcoal chemistry, and the science behind barbecue. Plus, are you a sucker for squid? Crazy for cuttlefish? It's a cephalopod roundup on Science Friday from PRI.
Friday afternoon at 1 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now we turn to World Cup. Don't try to act like you don't care. Although if you have been an American fan of what's known as the beautiful game for a while, well, you might feel like a regular worshiper on a big holiday. Who are all these people in your seat? And if it seems as though something is different this year, well, the television ratings confirm it. Last weekend's U.S.-Portugal match drew 25 million viewers, more than this year's NBA Finals or last year's World Series. And yesterday's decisive match with Germany that allowed the U.S. to advance to the Group of 16, even though the U.S. lost. Well, let's just say we weren't watching any congressional hearings yesterday during that time. But that got us wondering, why now? And why did it take so long for the U.S. to catch World Cup fever? So we've called in a World Cup veteran to help us out. George Vesey is a longtime sports columnist for the New York Times, where he is now a contributor. He has been to 8 World Cups, and he's author of the new book, 8 World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and Dark Side of Soccer. And he is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
So let's get some of the news out of the way. Germany beat the U.S. 1-0. Not unexpected, since Germany is one of the world's top teams, but give us your analysis of how Team USA performed. And also, if you don't mind, explain how it is that even though the USA lost, they still got to advance.
Well, they play in a group. There are 4 teams in it. It was called the Group of Death. There is always a Group of Death in any World Cup. And it's a compliment in a way to be in the Group of Death, because it means that you're a good team also. So while I short-sighted the American team in this World Cup, thinking they would finish 3rd or 4th, the fact is they had enough grit in Thursday's game to hold on. A 1-0 loss to Germany was enough to have them finish ahead of Portugal and Ghana, 2 teams that I thought would, frankly, finish ahead of them. So, as they say in soccer, a result, usually that means a draw or a victory. But in this case, the result is going through, and that's all that matters.
Now, I have to ask you just long term about how you feel the American team's prospects are. I mean, how do you think that they'll finish overall?
You know, in this World Cup, it's very hard to say. They play Belgium next, and Belgium's a better team. It's a tough road. I don't think the U.S. is anywhere near ready. They once reached the quarterfinals in 2002 in a similar scenario, just barely getting past the first round. But I don't think they're ready to compete at a semifinal or finalist level. They don't have the genius. They don't have the talent. But you certainly could see in this World Cup, they have more skill than they had a couple of decades ago.
And I do want to ask you about that chomp felt around the world. Luis Suarez of Uruguay has been suspended for 4 months after he, do we need to say allegedly?
You see, he lowers his head, he sticks his choppers into the guy's shoulder, and then there are marks on Chiellini's shoulder. Not only that, but this is the 3rd time that Suarez has done this. He really has what I would call a psychological and medical problem, and although he has been suspended for 9 games, which means the rest of this World Cup also, it's more than that. If FIFA doesn't mandate that he gets some kind of serious medical and psychological help, he has no business being back on the field at any time.
Well, I wanted to raise this for people who are new to the game. Just assure us that this is not a customary thing.
Do you mean biting?
No. Yeah, biting, yeah.
They do dirty things. I've seen elbows that broke eye sockets. I've seen a German goalkeeper just level a French guy. His teammates thought he was dead, lying on the ground. This was in 1982 at my first World Cup. But a bite is outside any kind of contact, collision, dirty, foul play. A bite is a bite.
Let's just go back a little bit and just talk about, you know, the sport as it's meant to be played. You were one of the first American sports columnists to cover soccer. And in fact, you actually played yourself. You don't probably mind my mentioning, not terribly well when you were
No, I mentioned it myself. In fact, I got a nice little award for the American Soccer Federation last year. And I got up there and I said, if you had ever seen me play fullback for Jamaica High School in the mid-1950s, I guarantee you would not even allow me up on this dais.
Talk a little bit more about what you actually like about it.
What I like about it is the creativity. When I watch good soccer players, the way they have to make a play out of nothing. The other night when the United States was playing Portugal and was in trouble during the match, their hard guy midfielder, Jermaine Jones, he worked his way around a screen, dribbled around 2 defenders, ball swerved, hooked inside the post, and scored a goal the U.S. desperately needed. And why did Jermaine Jones shoot that? Not a scorer. It came to him. He saw it. He created. I love that creativity.
We're talking with veteran New York Times sports columnist George Vesey. He's the author of the book 8 World Cups, because he's covered 8 World Cups. And we're talking to him about that. So you've got some interesting theories about why it is that soccer, to this point anyway, has not been a big deal in the United States, even though it's a very popular youth sport. What are some of your theories about why it is that soccer has been slow to catch on in this country?
Sure. The best and the brightest, the sports columnists around the country, I won't name names, but came up with these cockamamie theories that everybody knows that Americans only like sports in which you use your hands. Frankly, it doesn't mean anything. It's a way of covering up stick-in-the-mud mentality, lack of interest, and I think that's my generation. I mean, I'm an old guy. I'm mostly retired now, and they are, you know, at least in the professional sense, dying out. So I have no problem with saying that's passé, and frankly, they've been passé for 20 years.
Right, but hold on that second. You say in the book that soccer seemed to remind Americans of something they instinctively feared, foreign languages, foreign influences. What do you think that is?
Even some of my friends, my sports columnist friends who travel, who know the world, soccer bothered them. Did they equate soccer with, you know, what, mobs in the street, with riots? I couldn't even say. All I knew was I loved the nationalism. I loved being in Germany in 2006. To be there and see people daring, caring enough to fly their flag, to cheer, Deutschland, Deutschland. It was a wonderful thing to see them not being hesitant to show how patriotic they were.
You pointed out in the book, and I think as most people know who follow the sport at all, it's hugely popular among immigrants from, you know, Latin America, Africa, and other parts of the world where people grew up following the game. Do you think that whatever that was that kept people from appreciating the sport on the professional level, do you think that that kind of, that's been broken?
Look, this is the America that I live in. The other day, a guy got my car from a hotel in Philadelphia, and the guy's name was Mamadou. As I'm waiting for him to hand me the receipt, I said to him, "What's your team?" And he didn't tell me his nationality. He said, "Well, I always liked Brazil." But that's good enough for me. It's a flash of recognition. It's the humanity we share. And I think that the younger generation, first of all, they're familiar with the sport. They like the spectacle. They've adopted it as something they can do en masse with their time and their money. But there's also the broader sense that as younger people are more comfortable with people who are a little bit different. It's out there. They've been exposed to it. And now they're in their adult years. They have some money to spend. They're having a good time.
American football remains the most watched sport.
Of course.
On television. But there's increasingly some unhappiness about American football, just in terms of, you know, a lot of parents are concerned about concussions and health effects that they see. I just sort of wonder, do you think that soccer can move into a more preeminent place in our sports consciousness?
To some degree. I think that football has a real problem with the injuries when men who played professional football are saying they're not sure they would let their sons play. I'm not an evangelist for soccer. I would never tell somebody, give up your sport, either playing it or following it. I would never tell anybody to give up a hockey. The great sports we have here, basketball, lacrosse, rugby coming into its own. We've got so many great team sports, and I say hold on to it.
You've been to World Cups around the world, as we mentioned. Be honest, which country has, like, the best fans? If you weren't an American and you had to pick a country to be a soccer fan in, where would you go?
I don't think it's even close. The best fans in the world are in Brazil. I describe in the book my first adventure in Spain in beautiful Barcelona in 1982. I wander out of my hotel and I hear this sound, and there's a traveling troupe of 25 or 30 Brazilian people. The women were gorgeous. The men weren't bad either. The music, the horns, the guitars, and they're just walking through the Ramblas playing. But that translates into stadiums full of people. They are nice people, good fans. They love their team. And they don't have, that I know about, they don't have the ultras and the crazies and the locos and the hooligans like some nations we could mention.
So where are you going to be watching the rest of the matches?
Well, I want to say that I've because I'm not there and I'm not writing on deadline, when the Americans are playing, I have gone into seclusion to watch it because I need to take it all in. In other times I have watched in, would you believe that there are so many Belgians in New York City that I went to a place the other day where it was packed with Belgian people, including two giantesses carrying tridents and red horns on top of their head, which I'd like to think were not real. But it was quite a sight to be around all these people in the red jerseys. So I like being around when other teams are playing. You get a sense of it. But if I really want to watch, I want to be in a very small group.
Okay. George Vesey is a contributing sports columnist for the New York Times. He's author of the book 8 World Cups. He was with us from NPR New York. George Vesey, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for caring.
Now we're going to talk a bit about something many of us have experienced. If you've lost a job or had a relationship break off or maybe just a really bad day, have you ever reached for the chocolate ice cream or a big bowl of mashed potatoes? People call that stress eating or emotional eating, and it's something people seem to expect women to do. There are even jokes about it. But our next guest says men do this too, including African-American men. Caleb J. Hill says a series of personal traumas led him to eat his way up to 360 pounds. And he thinks the only way this negative cycle stops is if people start to talk about it. He wrote an essay about confronting this emotional eating habit in TheRoot.com. That's an online publication. It's titled Black Men and Emotional Eating. If no one else will talk about this, I will. And he's with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You were saying in your piece that this cycle of emotional eating started after your father died. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would. And I'm very sorry for your loss, by the way.
My father was on his way home, and he actually had an accident, but he was an emotional eater, too. He actually had type 2 diabetes that he didn't really treat. And because he died traumatically, it was a year after Hurricane Katrina, so we were still coping with the loss from Hurricane Katrina. And I noticed that myself, I had picked up some of those same habits. And with men, you know, they talk about the chocolate ice cream or the any type of fatty and sugary foods. With women, you always see the picture of a woman sitting in front of TV eating with the tissues and crying. But with men, sometimes it's pizza or steaks or even alcohol. So you never notice that the pounds start adding up so fast when you're eating like that. But with my father, losing him tragically was, it kind of triggered it.
You made 2 points in your essay. One is that you feel that a lot of people just don't recognize that this is happening with men. For example, you say that our definition of masculinity has an influence on the way a lot of us process our experiences. You're saying that, you know, you weren't encouraged to talk about it, I guess. You weren't encouraged to express your sadness. Would that be right?
Right. The way I was raised, you normally internalize things and you try to fix it yourself. You don't necessarily talk about your problems. And the crutch that we have can be food, or it can be lashing out emotionally on the people that actually are caring about us. So that's how I ended up being 360 pounds, because some of the foods I was still eating was somewhat healthy, but it was the quantity that I was eating.
You've said that there's an extra kind of racial element of it in your view, which you write about in your piece. You say that the black community often touts loyalty to others as the metric of realness, but this can come at the expense of living a fulfilled life. What is it about, like, this whole keeping it real thing? What is it that you felt if you wanted, you know, salad instead of mac and cheese, then somehow people would make fun of you, or you were not being keeping it real or something like
right.
that?
Right. In some ways, because I lost 114 pounds for over 2 years, when I did start changing the ways that I eat, if you don't want to eat the foods that you've grown up on, you know, people can take offense. So you want to be loyal to them, but sometimes it comes at the expense of your health, because they're not thinking about the calorie intake. They're more so thinking of the time that they put in to prepare, and that's their way of expressing love.
Hmm. So what made you realize something had to change? Do you remember?
The first thing that triggered is I couldn't wear any of the clothes in my closet. I was wearing pants with elastic, and I wanted to go to a concert, and there was a suit in my closet that I couldn't wear. That's when I realized that I was larger than I thought I was, because I've always been kind of stocky, but I didn't realize that I had gained so much weight, because I hadn't been going to the doctor and weighing myself. And the other thing is my family has a history of chronic illness, and I was my grandmother's caregiver. She had type 1.5 diabetes, and I was her caregiver from a small age. So I watched her have to change everything that she did with her life around that one disease. And like I said, my father had it, and that was just not something I wanted to have to include in my life.
How did you go about getting a hold of the situation? I mean, you also mentioned that there were a lot of other underlying issues involved. I mean, the people call it emotional eating for a reason. And you had a lot of stuff to deal with. You know, you were having panic attacks and anxiety and a number of other things that you were dealing with. So what's your word of wisdom about this? I mean, is it total focus on that issue, like throw everything at it, focus on everything at once? Or did you do the weight first and then the other stuff followed? Or what's your guidance on this?
From my experience, I actually started volunteering for a gym, and I offered to clean the gym twice a day in exchange for the services that they offer with fitness and nutrition. And once I started to exercise, I noticed that I started to have more energy and I was more confident. So the mental aspect was addressed with the exercising, because I was recluse for a long time after my father was killed. So me getting up and just getting out the house and just walking at least half a mile and getting fresh air was just a little bit of like a confidence boost. So when I started to lose the weight, the mental health issues were addressed. I spoke to a therapist for about 6 months. Now I have those tools that help with the anxiety. And if I notice anything triggering that might make me go back into emotional eating, I have tools from the therapy sessions that help me. That's one of the things I want to encourage people that share my racial and ethnic background is to seek therapy if they need it. If you need professional help as far as getting the tools that you need to cope with whatever it may be, anxiety, it could be anxiety and depression because sometimes they go hand in hand. But if you need that professional help, go get it.
How do you feel now that you put it out there?
I feel good because I feel like in society, if we don't see things, we don't believe that it happens. We feel like it's just us. So for me, putting myself out there, I want other brothers to feel like they can talk about the issues that they're having before something tragic happens.
Caleb J. Hill is founder and CEO of Fitness Fleet. His essay, Black Men and Emotional Eating, If No One Else Will Talk About This, I Will, appeared in the online journal The Root. We reached him in New Orleans. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Mr. Hill. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Barbershop Guys give their take on the latest men's fashion trend.
Everybody's talking about my tight pants. I got my tight pants. I got my tight pants on.
Oh, yes, we are going to ask the guys about whether they're wearing tight pants. It is the barbershop, not the beauty shop. You don't want to miss it. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, with a diagnostic exam and treatment plan for advanced stage patients seeking a second opinion at cancercenter.com. From Carnegie Corporation, proud supporter of StoryCorps, sharing stories of new citizens. More at greatimmigrants.carnegie.org. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to support strong families and communities for America's children at AECF.org. This is NPR.
It's amazing how fast time flies, isn't it? For example, did you know that June 30th is this upcoming Monday? Of course, here at WILL, we've been counting down to that date as it's the end of our fiscal year. And we've had some amazing support over the last 12 months. In fact, we are now within $100,000 of our overall goal. But time is now of the essence. So if you've been meaning to make a gift, don't delay. Call 217-244-9455 or go online to willpledge.org. Thank you.
Whoever double-crosses me and leaves me alive, he understands nothing about Tuco. Nothing.
That's Eli Wallach playing Tuco in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. His career spanned over 60 years. Wallach died Tuesday at the age of 98. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our 1990 interview. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elm and University in the historic Trevette Mansion, across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
I'm I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our writer Jimmy Israel, with us from Cleveland. Neil Minkoff is a healthcare consultant and a contributor to National Review Online. He's with us from Boston. From NPR West, which is in Culver City, Los Angeles, film writer, actor, and producer Rick Nahara. And in Washington, D.C., Paul Butler. He's a law professor at Georgetown University. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, the gang's all here.
Yeah.
Welcome to the shop.
What's up?
Hey. I'll get my Manny Petty on.
I got mine yesterday, bro. So
all right.
On like Donkey Kong. You know, picking up where Michelle's last conversation, we can just be serious for just a second. You know, you guys know the death of my wife really had me kind of doing a little bit of stress eating, which I've recovered from. But I'm certainly happy that Caleb Hill put that topic out in the ether. So bless that brother, man, for real.
Yeah.
Paul Butler, you doing any stress eating, bro?
You know, I have to say, I never heard of a black man with an eating disorder until this brother wrote this piece. But I get it. Being an African-American man in the United States is very stressful. Mm-hmm. You know, I think about it in the context of being a criminal lawyer, because I think people expect that black men take it out with aggression or we self-medicate with drugs. But, you know, some brothers do turn in ways that aren't healthy. So I think it's important to put it out there that there's no shame in getting help.
Absolutely. Dr. Neil, you're a former primary care doctor. Jump in this conversation, man.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen this across all races and actually across both genders. You know, I think that to me, one of the things that's really key here is that men just avoid medical care and especially behavioral health care. I mean, there was a running joke in our practice that if a young man came into the office, we'd ask, you know, did your wife, girlfriend, or mother make the appointment? Because we knew that the young man wouldn't. And as soon as we started doing things like depression screening or alcohol screening, they would get even more uncomfortable. And sometimes I was afraid it was driving them away. I mean, I've seen this. I think that this is actually pervasive, just especially with men, but stress eating happens to all races, genders, creeds.
Do you think, Neil, can I ask you this? Do you think that, you know, Caleb Hill was very clear about why he wanted to write this piece, because he felt very strongly that it's the kind of thing that if you don't think this is possible, you're not even going to consider this as a possibility in your life. Do you think it makes a difference if somebody like him talks about something like this? If you think that this is the kind of thing that matters in helping people feel more okay about seeking the kind of care that they need?
So I do. I do think it matters. I think that there is a structural, cultural issue, though, where I agree. And I like the fact that he brought it up, especially, you know, the guy at the table that orders salad gets picked on. And that happens everywhere. I've seen it happen again, all, you know, through all different walks of life. And I think that it needs to be more of a discussion about the redefinition of masculinity, and that taking care of yourself can be a positive thing to do as a male, even if it means that you're eating salad with dressing on the side.
Can I just jump in?
Okay, go ahead, man. Jump in.
No, just
please.
Real quick, because I do think there's a black part of this too. Because in the piece in The Root, he said that black men need to admit that we are vulnerable. And I just feel like that's something I could never do. I feel like if I said I was vulnerable, the world would just swoop down on me.
Wow.
Yeah.
I feel that way too, though.
Wait a second. Dr. Neil, I want to push back a little bit. I wonder if this just isn't, and maybe Rick, Nahara, you can maybe get to this. I wonder if this isn't just among men of a certain age. Because in my crew, I mean, you get talked about if you don't eat a salad. It's like, bro, what you doing with that po' boy, B? You know, you better get down with that Caesar. You know, maybe it's just men of a certain age.
Well, I think it's just everyone's confusion about nutrition and all the rest. One is people of color, especially men, never want to admit they're weak or have a problem or vulnerable. And that's true because, you know, Mexico's got right now one of the highest obesity rates and along with America. And I think it's because the stress creates it all. I mean, Mexico went through, of course, a continuing drug war. And I think there's all those things of processed food, stress, thousand things that make it happen. And it's a more subtle thing to watch weight than to say, hey, I've got a drug problem or I've got this other big problem. But weight will kill you. You know, my brother died of a weight disease. So you see epidemics of diabetes in the Latino culture. So I think it's not even age. Because if a younger brother said, get a Caesar salad First of all, Caesar salad's got a lot of calories in it. You know, people aren't realizing
well,
that.
Well, it's true that. But it matters.
Salad bar. Okay.
Well, can I just ask though, Neil? Can I go back and ask you something about what Paul said? You had when he said, "Look, I still don't feel like I can admit to being vulnerable." And Neil, you said you felt the same way.
Well, I think that a lot of men feel that way, which is that we've been raised to be the rock, to be the foundation of the family, to be the stable one, and to admit and to, you know, especially in a business environment, to admit vulnerability is to admit weakness and be perceived as less capable. And so I certainly have seen and heard that from people of many different colors. So I respect what Paul said. I'm not pushing back. I'm just saying that I think there might be a more common denominator than that.
No, I'm hearing you on that, because one of the things I think is interesting is how we often talk about how, you know, women regulate other women. I mean, people say, oh, well, women are dressing for men and they're doing this for men. And so actually, women are regulating other women. And I wonder if the same thing is true of men. If a man... Because I certainly don't feel that way about the men in my life. You know, well, I appreciate the fact that they're, you know, complete people, and I would hope that they had all the same emotions that, you know, women have. But I just wonder, is this a thing where men do this to other men? Men are the ones who saying to other men, this is what you're not allowed to be.
Men don't do that when it comes to weight. I mean, no. I don't see a lot of guys really talking to other guys about weight. It's a weird thing to look at a brother and say, you know, I notice your pants a little tighter. You know, they're not going to do that. That's the least of it, you know.
Well, yeah, and it's weird you should talk about that, because according to a lot of fashion writers, baggy is out, and the tight pants look on gentlemen, it's in. I'm told hip huggers for men. Yeah, whatever.
I think that's
but
true.
Anyway,
I'm sorry. I think that's true. I mean, if you can look at what they're throwing down at, you know, Banana Republic or whatever. I think that is true.
Yeah, right. You mean places true. Brothers don't shop? But you know, comedian Jimmy Fallon rocks the look, and he even made a few skits out of it. Let's drop that clip.
I'm the only one in town with tight pants. I got my tight pants. I got my tight pants on. No one else around is wearing tight pants. I got my tight pants. I got my tight pants on.
What people are reacting to is a surprise, sort of kind of surprise appearance by J-Lo, who is also definitely wearing some tight pants. So.
Yeah, I wear tight pants just because I'm an emotional eater. So all my pants are tight.
Come on. Yeah.
Do you rock that look, though? No, seriously, Rick, are you going to rock that look?
I will rock the look. Unfortunately, I wear tight pants because it's, you know, it's also a youth thing. It's if you're a guy and you're in Hollywood, if you're wearing the older baggy pants, they kind of think of you as older. But it's almost you have to wear a tight fitting clothing, and unfortunately, if you don't have a great body for it, you're in big trouble.
So
you know, we don't have the rapper look.
Yeah, to keep viable, Paul. What
That's
about you?
Weird.
I think tight pants on men are kind of gross. The only thing is, I do have some tight jeans that make me feel kind of cool when I wear them. I feel like a rock star. I think the real issue, though, is tailoring. My boy Joe, he used to be a model, and he hooked me up with the whole concept of getting clothes tailored, and that's how they fit. I think a lot of men, you know, when you buy a suit, you got to take it to a tailor. It doesn't fit otherwise. So we think it looks tight, but it really just fits.
No, I mean, that's the whole look. A good fitted clothing should look good. I'm watching the World Cup, and it seems like every single European coach looks good, like out of GQ. So
I think there's a difference. This is Jimmy. I think there's a difference between, you know, the tight fit and what's supposed to fit. You know, I can't wear no like tight fit jeans. I mean, my boys need room to move, but I certainly get my stuff gets tailored. I mean, I have to go to the tailor. I mean, preach that talk, Paul. I mean, a lot of grown men are walking around with stuff right off the rack, and that is not the look. Neil?
I just need to ask if Jimmy gets his sarongs tailored too. Okay, Jimmy.
I get my sarongs at Moshood in Brooklyn for Green, and they are not tailored.
Okay. I just had to ask.
Off the rack.
Shout out to Moshood.
I've been known to see you in a. I've seen you in a sarong.
I'm wearing one now.
Okay. I'm actually wearing jeans so tight that I have to stand up to do this program.
Is that because you're so fly?
No, I wear jeans every day, and slim fit is what. What is the appropriate thing these days? You know, you got to change with the times. And I agree with Paul completely. Your clothes need to be fitted to you, not the other way around.
Yeah, slim fit's cool, but, you know, hard to wear.
Okay, but what is up with, like, those pitbull pants during the World Cup opening ceremony? Like, what is up with that? I'm sorry. I just need to understand what was happening here, Rick.
Can I answer that as
Please.
Latino?
Yeah,
let me tell you. Pitbull's from Miami. I know the man. He's a great guy. And Miami is dealing, of course, with global warming, and the water is rising. And I think it's a future look. And Miami's got pirates, okay? So it's indigenous to their area to wear pants that look like a pirate.
Is that what was happening there?
That's what's happening there. He was celebrating pirate culture and also talking about global warming all in that one
so
moment.
So we're being insensitive by even highlighting the fact that...
We're being ignorant.
A little rough.
That's all
that
we're being ignorant.
I'm sorry. Okay, I'm sorry.
Pitbull's doing the right thing.
All right,
I apologize. That explains a lot about the Miami Heat post-game conference dress code as well then.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What? How's
the capri pants and the shirts and stuff. Everybody's just making sure that when the flood rises, they'll be fine.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
See, I'm still a fan of the Pharrell Williams shorts, evening shorts. I'm sorry. I know I'm alone in this. But I don't care. I'm standing up for the evening shorts. I think that was completely fly if you have good-looking calves.
Are you standing up for his hat, too?
I'm a fan of the hat.
Whoa.
I'm a fan of the hat.
Yeah, the hat was dope.
I think the hat was dope. The Canadian Mountie hat. That's how
I
saw it.
Was cool
I thought it was
kind
of a transnational
hat. That was dope.
Situation.
Yeah.
He
looked like he was with the Forest Service, and I appreciate that.
Shout out to Vivian Westwood.
That's right. If you're having we're having our weekly barbershop roundtable. We're joined by writer Jimmy Israel, writer and actor Rick Mehera, law professor Paul Butler, and healthcare consultant Neil Minkoff. Back to you, Jimmy.
All right. Thank you, Michelle. All you dapper dudes, let's stop from the talk about sarongs and tight pants and this, that, and the third. You know, to knee socks. No, all right. I'm just kidding, actually. You know, kind of, sort of. Because what I'm actually talking is I'm talking World Cup. The U.S. lost to Germany yesterday, but they are still in it to win it, maybe. They take on Belgium next Tuesday. Dr. Neil, last week you said the U.S. team is, quote, decent-ish. Are you surprised they're still in it?
I'm surprised that we have a sport, you know, coming from American sport culture where it's a best of five, best of seven, or a one-on, win and go home. The fact that a team can be one win, one loss, and one tie and be considered successful is amazing to me.
You're not hating, are you? You're not, like, subtly hating, are you?
I'm not. But, I'm just surprised. Okay. I'm shocked.
I think so. You might have to, like, do some math. I don't know, Paul. Are you watching it? Are you liking it?
No, I'm enjoying the hype around it, but the game itself puts me to sleep. You know, I don't get it. I mean, everyone was so into the game yesterday. We lost, but we still advanced. I just don't get the math. Yeah, I do have one moment, though, like when the U.S. is playing an African country like we play Ghana. I don't know who to root for, and I don't know how to feel about that. Does that make me unpatriotic?
Well, there's a black guy on the American team. So
I know, but it's just like, you know, Africa. We don't get to see that many sports teams from Africa or any like, really competitive enterprises from Africa. So it's just, you know, I feel kind of proud, actually.
Yeah, you know, I think
the root for the team is rooting for you.
Yeah, the World Cup does that because they got Mexico in the World Cup. So, of course, I'm for Mexico and America at the same time. So, yeah, and the South Americans, I'm not as much for.
Well, what about you, Jimmy?
I'm not conflicted. I'm always cheering for Cleveland's soccer team.
Yeah.
So,
I think Americans don't get the World Cup because they also don't get the metric system either. So I think there's cultural differences.
Look, you know what? I'm sorry. I hate to burst you all's bubble, but the ratings for that game, for the U.S.-Portugal game, were higher than for the NBA Finals, and they were also higher than last year's World Series. Yo, hello,
yo,
boom,
wow.
That, boom, that.
Well,
okay,
yeah.
So somebody's watching it.
But would they watch it if it was every year? I mean, is it the fact that it's every 4 years it's this giant spectacle that brings out the curious to watch it rather than the actual genuine passion for what's happening?
I think that's true. I mean, would you watch figure skating every week if it wasn't during the Olympics?
No.
No.
No, but I mean, I think that, I don't know, though, because I think that soccer is the biggest youth sport in America. It's one of the biggest youth sports in America. I think more kids probably play soccer than play youth football. just because for no other reason than because girls can play soccer and girls can, and the American girls team have been, you know, competitive internationally for some time now. And I just think it's changing. I think that people, more people understand the sport, more people grew up playing the sport, and I just think that it's having a, I don't think it's just a moment. I don't know. That's just
you know what's kind of interesting? My son's really into soccer. He plays it all the time, and he's about 10. They'll have him play against 12-year-old and 13-year-old girls to practice. So the boys play with the girls. So it is kind of a co-ed sport in a strange way as it's growing up. So both sides love it. My wife's a huge soccer fan. So I think that's what's driving it. It's male, female, and young.
And the haircuts are awesome. I just want to mention that for anybody who cares. I'm sorry. They are. I'm just saying. These are like hair leaders. These are hair gurus.
Oh, yeah.
They are like, yes. Okay, we have just a couple minutes left. So let's talk about this. A handwritten manuscript for Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone sold at auction this week for a record-breaking $2 million. And I just wanted to ask if there's a song that you would pay $2 million for, like assuming you had that kind of scratch. I don't know. Paul, would you?
I think anyone who has $2 million who spends it on a song lyric needs to be beaten with sticks. I will throw out, there's this obscure song by Prince called Starfish and Coffee, and it's about this weird little kid who marched to her own drummer, and we get these random facts about her. Her favorite number was 20, and in her lunchbox, that's what she had, Starfish and Coffee. I gotta love that song. At the end of it, Prince says, you go, girl, you do you. You do your Starfish and Coffee.
I love it. Rick, you got one?
Yeah, music is business. I would buy Born in the USA because some rich white guy is going to buy that song and put it in a commercial. So it's an investment. That's the way I look at it.
All right, Neil, what about you? You got a song you'd pay $2 million for if you had it that and could escape from Prince Paul beating you with a stick?
So I don't know. That just seems like a crazy amount. I mean, to spend something like that, unless it's an investment like was just referenced, I mean, it'd have to be something historically like major, like the Grapes of Wrath or something. You know, I mean, it would have to be something that you'd get and then donate to the Smithsonian or something.
Yeah, that could happen. Jimmy, you got one?
Yeah, the 23rd Psalm, but nothing else.
Okay.
That's it.
All right. Jimmy Israel is a writer. You can find his blog at jimmyisrael.com. Neil Minkoff is a healthcare consultant and contributor to National Review Online. Paul Butler is a law professor at Georgetown University. Rick Nahara is a film and television writer. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Yep.
And if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast. That's in the iTunes store or at npr.org. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more on Monday.